Jason Yonker, the University of Oregon's tribal liaison to sovereign domestic governments.
What kinds of things do you do?
Broadly, I would say things on campus that have to do with American Indians or the relationship with the tribes. Off of campus, it's maintaining the very good relationships that we do have, primarily with the 9 federally recognized tribes here in the state of Oregon, but extended are another 34 tribes that we consider Oregonians, like, for example, the Modoc, who were removed from southern Oregon, northern California, and now live in Oklahoma. We consider that tribe, that nation, as an Oregon resident. So for purposes of tuition, students from the Modoc tribe of Oklahoma can come to the U of O for in-state tuition purposes. I originally grew up in Coos Bay, Oregon, actually in Charleston, on South Slough of Coos Bay, so where Oregon Institute of Marine Biology is located. Everything south of that is where my family lived, and that's where my father's village was located. That's where they grew up during the Depression era. It was really the slums of Coos Bay, if you can imagine such a thing. That's where all the Indians lived, was down in Charleston, Oregon. So I grew up there and was very fortunate to do so. My childhood, I was a terminated Indian, so it was very difficult to be native. It was dirty to be native when I grew up. Fortunately, after I graduated from college, we became restored. The Coquel Indian tribe was restored in 1989. And that's when I went back to graduate school in Oklahoma City and eventually came back to Oregon to teach. And that's when my tribe said, we don't need any more teachers. We need an anthropologist. So they sent me to the U of O. And I studied here for 10 years, receiving my PhD and master's. Then I went away to teach in New York. And when this position opened up, they asked me to apply. And so I did. And I've been here for 5 years and enjoyed being home. It's very hard to get good salmon in New York. I remember growing up hearing all of these different stories from various people, like back when Prohibition, our family used to make money running moonshine up South Slough, and they would have revenuers coming and chasing us all the time, but we knew South Slough, they didn't. And another thing that one of my uncles told me, they said, we were paddling up the slough, rowing up the slough, going to one of the stills. And this was my Uncle Bob telling me this. And he said, Uncle Tom shot at this blue heron. And I said, why did you shoot at that blue heron? Why were you trying to kill that blue heron? And he said, I wasn't trying to kill it. If I wanted to kill it, I would have shot it. And back in those days, bullets were at a premium, you know. But when he shot at that blue heron, this blue heron took off and just kind of like a pterodactyl, you know? And it echoed throughout the entire slough. He said, I shot at that blue heron because when the revenuers come, that blue heron will be jumpy and will do the same exact thing. That's our alarm system, which made complete sense to me. Well, if somebody is removed from a location after having a long extended generational tie to a place, those memories are recorded in stories and in context with that location. And you would always tell a story at the location where it was created because it reminds you of all of the different aspects on the landscape. So when Native Americans were removed from these different locations, it would only take 1, 2, 3 generations before the context was completely removed from the story, and it only became an oral tradition without the context. So if you can, and I use this analogy in class, watch a movie without the picture on. that's what the story would be like. It's very difficult to put things into your head and remember things unless you have a picture, a context to place it with. And so that's why I know the removal of the Coquel from certain locations on the landscape really hurt the continuance of our oral traditions as well as our ability to remember some of these things. And that was by design, to remove people from locations and so that they would assimilate. So it was an assimilationist protocol.
You were involved with bringing some pieces of history back from the Smithsonian, is that right? Do those sorts of things help heal in a small way?
Oh, wow. I just talked about this the other day. I'll tell it in a story. Back in the 90s, I was part of the Southwest Oregon Research Project. It was to recover as much information that was collected about the Coquel and surrounding tribes and to copy those archival documents and bring them back so that they would be more accessible to the people that it most matters to. We were at the National Anthropological Archives, the National Archives, and the Library of Congress, and our host said, "You're a small tribe, we'll copy it, whatever you find. We'll pay for the copies." Well, we left there with 60,000 pages worth of information. And they were not expecting that. But, you know, that effort, it was their number one sponsorship of the year. And so we got on their cover, their magazine, stuff like that. So it was very, very successful. We ended up making a central archive here at the University of Oregon because it's a central location in Oregon. And then we potlatched that archive to the different tribes that it made a difference for. We were invited a few years later to come back. This time they didn't offer to pay for any copies. We found about 50,000 pages more. So it's a very, very large archive of all about Oregon, and, you know, with military documents, with some photographs and maps, linguistic notes, ethnography. Is just very, very rich in information, most of which I don't understand, but there are people who do understand, and that's the importance of bringing it back to where those who have expertise can take a look at it and make some sense out of it. But when I was growing up, we had always asked, why aren't we Indian? Well, you're terminated. Yeah, but why are we terminated? Because they lost the map. And as a young kid, you continually ask this only to see more and more pain every time you hear they lost the map, they lost the map, they lost the map. That makes no sense to me because I don't know what the map is. I just know it's a map. Well, we did a little research and it just happened that when the treaties of Western Oregon were drawn up by Joel Palmer, he created this large map that showed all of the lands that were ceded and the proposed Great Coast Reservation where all of the Western Oregon Indians were supposed to go. And it's from like Florence all the way up to the mouth of the Columbia River and then up to the crest of the Cascade Range. It was a very large location. Well, they sent Joel Palmer's treaties to Congress in the 1850s. Along with the map, but they sent the map in a tube and the treaties in a document, and the map got lost. The treaties arrived to Congress, and they said, well, we can't act on these until we see the map. So it isn't until the 1880s that they actually read the treaties into Congress when the map was then found. But by then, it had been 30, 40 years, and there was no more Oregon Indian problem. They had run away from the reservation. They had been prematurely sent to this coast reservation and starved. So they left. And that's how my family survived. We were able to stay in Coos Bay, but my grandmother and other family members ran away. My brother and I are sitting in College Park looking at the National Archive maps. And we come across this very large-scale map, and it shows the Great Coast Reservation. It shows all of the ceded territories, and we looked at each other, and we knew exactly what it was. We said, this is the lost map. So we made a very nice copy of it, and when we came back to report to the Coquille Tribal Council, we were talking about all the different things that we found, and then we rolled out the map, and we said, this is the map that was lost with our treaties. This is the lost map. And people wept because all the lost map had been to them were two words, lost map. And that's why you're not a Coquille. So when we opened that up, it made perfect sense why we weren't Coquille for such a long time. To have that one piece of paper mean something, and to watch people as they touched it and pointed at it, and things made sense, more and more sense to them. There was more healing in the unveiling of that map than I think I have seen in a long time for the Coquille tribe. I think there's lots of things that are very, very exciting happening here at the U of O, actually happening all around the state of Oregon. Sanibel 13, of course, it's about time. We are behind as a state. Other states have done this. So Senate Bill 312 just passed the House and the Senate, and that is another huge step, actually, where Native American students from any tribe who graduate from an Oregon high school or a high school in Oregon are afforded the benefits of in-state tuition. And that makes a gigantic difference for students at Chamawa Indian School who are from everywhere but Oregon. There are 12 students from Oregon at Chamawa out of the 350. And Chamawa provides services to 8 of the 10 poorest reservations in the United States. Now, those reservations have been designated as in extreme poverty, which means that the head of household earns $3,000 or less per year. So if you are a student in one of those reservations or one of those families, there is no way you're going to be able to afford a $50 application fee to college, or you don't eat for a month. Right now, the biggest challenge is to provide access to the poorest class of students, which has always been Native Americans, which is a shame since the United States and the wealthiest country in the world is profited from the lands that used to be American Indians. We live in the West, and out-of-state tuition is just unaffordable. And with the rising tuition costs, it's making higher education anywhere unaffordable to the lowest possible class. It's always been my belief that a university anywhere should at least meet the state percentage of population. So for American Indians right now here on campus, there's 0.5%, which is pretty much the same at other state institutions. However, within the state of Oregon, we have 1.8% of Native Americans. So the University of Oregon, Oregon State, all of us should have 1.8% Native Americans. The Chamawa bill, that makes things a lot better, but we're not quite there yet. We also have to think in very long-term strategy. What University of Oregon is trying to do is to help undermine all of the impacts of assimilation at the same time educating the tribal students in different areas that would help the tribes. Assimilation has been taking place since the 1850s, even earlier than that. There is no way we're going to be able to accomplish that in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We need to think more like American Indians and say, okay, where do we want to be in 100 years? There's my 100-year on the board there.
It goes to the year 2120.
Yes. And so we need to think of it. Where do we want to be in 2120 with the passage of Senate Bill 13, Senate Bill 312? Those are actually very large steps, but they barely make a blip on the timeline. What can we do next? And we just keep chipping away at it. If we accomplish one little chip per year, you know, by 2120, we are going to have 5% Native Americans on campus. We're going to have everybody getting full ride scholarships who is Native American. That's the thing that I'm optimistic about. And I know I will never, ever get to see that day. Long life does run in my family, but not that long. So that's what I'm optimistic about, is seeing all of the little things that are happening now and knowing where they are leading to in the future.